Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to Castle of Horror, the show dedicated to horror movies and awesomeness. This week, we have a look at the 1972 film Deathmaster, directed by Ray Danton. This is episode 396. Bear in mind, if you haven't seen today's movie, we're going to be talking about it from the perspective of horror fans who have seen it. So warning, spoilers ahead. From Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Jason Henderson, publisher at Castle Bridge Media, home of the Castle of Horror anthology. With me from Austin is Tony Salvaggio, lead singer and bassist of the band Deserts of Mars and lead guitarist of the band Rise from Fire. Say hello, Tony.
Howdy.
Howdy. Also in Austin, Mr. Drew Edwards is the writer, creator of the long-running underground comic Halloween Man, which you can find at Global Comics. He is a Best Writer Ringo nominee, Austin Chronicle, Best of Austin Award winner, and a member of the Pen America Fellowship. Say hello, Drew.
I just want to go to town to have some steak and whiskey.
Oh, so good.
Oh, that guy. And finally, also in Denver, big fan of this movie, I think. color commentary from Julia Guzman of Guzman Immigration of Denver. Say hello, Julia.
Hello, Julia.
I have no idea why I said that, because you didn't particularly not like this movie. So I don't know. I'm actually giddy with just pure joy about talking about this movie. And it's okay if you guys do not like it, because this is one of those movies that I feel Teflon. I feel like my love for this movie cannot be tainted by logic. So, all right. Deathmaster. Deathmaster is a strange creature. It is a sort of sequel. I'm calling it that. I don't care what it actually is. It is a sort of sequel to Count Yorga and Return of Count Yorga, starring the star of those movies, Robert Corey, except this time Corey plays Corda, a mysterious vampire who appears in Southern California as a cult leader, a guru to a bunch of local young people. And it seems like this movie was actually filmed between the original Count Yorga and Return of Count Yorga. So it's got a very, very strange history, and we're going to do our best at that. So, all right. Let's get our opening thoughts, and then we'll get into it. We'll go Julia, Tony, Drew, and then I'll go, because we haven't started with Julia in a couple of weeks. Julia, what are your opening thoughts? Why do you laugh?
My opening thought is that I psychically intuited that you were going to start with me, and then you were going to say, because we haven't started with Julia in a while.
That's true.
I was like, okay, here we go.
There's a certain predictability, yes. And I'm sorry. Okay. Uh-huh. But what did you think of Deathmaster?
I was amused by it. I definitely found it amusing. I think is the best way to put it. I like the whole kind of Manson family vibe of the hippies. I think it's an interesting idea to have a vampire that, you know, becomes the guru. I think it was called Guru Vampire when they were shooting it. It was like their shooting title. But yeah, the vampire is the person that they're all like, oh, you know, we want to be part of your cult, dude. And you know, and they have this amazing setting that I'm not exactly sure how it is that they managed to find and be in this place, but it's a gorgeous like castle. Yeah. So all of that was pretty clever and just kind of an interesting twist on the whole vampire thing. I like the guru. I like the Robert Corey character. I think he's you know, groovy, and I like his really cool you know, kind of guru coat that he wears. You know, but that's not, I mean, it's pretty dumb. There's a lot of dumb stuff in it. You know, I don't know. I think that's about, I like the clothing too. I thought the clothing, all of the clothing was cool. So there were things I liked, and but I did think it was kind of dumb.
All right. All right. Tony, what are your thoughts?
Deathmaster, bring me a vamp. I also thought of this as the as some kind of weird inception of Jared Leto's. Like, he's been Morbius, and he's also been a cult leader. So are we living in a simulation, and this things just keep going about? I don't know. It's kind of an interesting movie. It's weird that it's so hard to find.
Yes.
And it also, the score and the vibe feels really like a TV movie. And again, I don't mean that as a bad thing. It just struck me as the way the score is done and the pacing and how it's cut. I mean, I don't remember any fades to black, but like it has that vibe, and I was surprised that it wasn't. And again, that's not a bad thing. It just reminded me of that. I'm still curious. Like, I wonder how many actual hippies were like, oh, why are we portrayed
no
this
hippies
way?
Were or, hurt during the making of this
but were they portrayed like, are they mad, or is that if this was a time capsule of hippie dumb, the most annoying people ever, just I can't stand them in this movie. The bikers aren't much better, but I cannot. Oh man, I just, and this is from somebody who gets accused of being too nice or maybe being hippy dippy about things, but there's something about true hippie dumb, especially in media, right?
Yeah,
because in the same way that beatniks are portrayed, like there's a bunch of beatniks who are like, come on, man, really? But that over the top, or punks, right? Like,
right,
all punks, like Quincy punks,
right,
are real punks. Like,
thank you. I have to flag on the play. I just have to mention that what you're referring to with Quincy punks is there was an episode of Quincy where Quincy, for reasons that remain mysterious to me, discovers punk rock and thinks it's too dangerous.
Right.
Or
Moloch and Chips, right? With like his pseudo kiss. All those movements in media are often overblown.
Yes.
But insufferable in this movie. But you know, they get controlled by a vampire, and that's kind of interesting. So, but it's as a movie, it's really interesting. You know, it's got a kung fu hippie. That's interesting. It's got hippies and bikers kind of mixing it up. I don't know. It's entertaining. It's an interesting piece as kind of a side Yorga thing, which I think is fascinating. But yeah, I don't regret seeing it. But boy, there were parts where I was just, spare me insufferable hippies. I think I don't know, for some reason that trope and that attitude, and I don't know if it's because I deal with flaky musicians a lot or what, but and I gotta say, I bet that mansion just reeks. That many hippies at that time period. Sorry. And again, like, I try to be a nice person, and like, I shouldn't be the one making kind of dirty hippie references. But boy, when you see it, you're just like, at least I bet it smelled like patchouli, something fierce.
I was gonna say there's probably a fair amount of incense. But hold that thought, because anyway. I want to get back to the hippie stuff.
Yeah.
But let's see what Drew has to say. Drew, are you coming down more or less where Tony is, or are you anywhere else?
So, like Julia, I was amused. I feel like that where I would put the hippies in this is more along the, like, they very much remind me of the hippies that they would occasionally have on Get Smart whenever the groovy guru was the villain of the week.
Yeah.
You know, like, these are like very super stereotypical, probably what a middle-aged person idea of what a hippie was like, because I'm assuming that like the person that wrote this was not actually from, you know, any of the subcultures portrayed here. Robert,
he might have been a vampire.
There you go. You know, Robert Quarry is great in this. Like, I don't know if I 100% buy that a group of young people would listen to him, Mm-hmm. He, as much as this is like Yorga adjacent, I do think he does a pretty good job of making this guy seem, well, different in its way from Yorga, which I thought is pretty cool. My other takeaway, though, and I've said this several times when we've been sort of talking about the movie the last several days.
Yeah.
I think this movie is pretty entertaining as it is. I think it would be 100% better if the like main character hero, whatever you want to call him, if the main hippie that ends up being the hero was not, and the like brutish knucklehead biker dude that is just...
Yeah.
Cynical, like I think if you had replaced those two, like swapped out those two characters, this movie would have become so much more entertaining, because like the whole reason why the guy is the hero by default is because he thinks that all the hippie, you know, the hippie stuff is bull crap, and he's just there to eat meat, score with chicks and party.
Can you imagine if instead what we got was a movie where he, you know, befriends the one guy, our kung fu hippie.
Yes.
And then when things go bad, he enlists all the bikers, so that's like the end of Return of the Living. I mean, right? Night of the Living
Dead. That's a wonderful idea.
Day of the Dead. Yeah. Day of the Dead.
Dawn of the Dead. Can you,
Dawn of the, why am I know this. I don't know why my brain is. but you're, every zombie movie except that, because my brain is dumb tonight.
No.
So yes, of course, Dawn of the Dead, of course.
That would have been
one of my all-time favorite movies. But can you imagine how crazy that would have been?
Well, because, you're right. The movie opens and you have bikers versus hippies, but then the bikers just go away. And it's just the one biker.
Well, except for the one, and he doesn't survive.
The one
survive,
who becomes friends with them. No, they're like bikers versus hippies. The main biker and main hippie guy get into a fight because our hero hippie
because
it's
bikers
like,
versus hippies, which was the thing of the time, right?
Our hero,
and because they are hassling
our hero hippie wants to defend the jewelry sales guy that, you know, Pop.
John Fiedler.
And so he's like, leave him alone. So they get into a fight. And then when the what does she call it? The heat shows up, the cops.
They run off
and suddenly they're BFFs. They're like, hey, let's go have dinner together.
Yeah, because everybody, again, this is the 70s. So when the fuzz shows up, everybody's on like all the countercultures. The fuzz is there to break your good time. And everything else, and to take you away. I don't know how we've gotten to where we are now, but counterculture movies of the time, when the fuzz shows up, they're like, we got to get out of it. We got to, you know, beat. And that's part of, that's how they bond, is like, well, we both don't want the law coming after us. So
And mind you, right before that scene, you've got Bill Ewing, who plays Pico, who's our young point of view character, young hero. He does some like kung fu, basically.
It's more like jiu-jitsu kind of. So I mean, I'm sure somebody, you know, with martial arts training.
And he wears hippie clothes and hippie beads.
Yeah,
and
he calls it kung fu.
And he wears his hair in an in a sort of American Indian style with a headband. I mean, he is everything. Here's my take on all of this. Like why is the biker guy not the point of view character? And the answer is because this movie isn't really for hippies and it's not really for bikers. This movie is for more or less the straights in like most of America who have gone to the drive-in and they see this movie and they don't really, they're not hippies per se, but they know, they get the idea, and they get the idea that hippies are a little more close to home than scary bikers. And so you have, so that's the gradation, right?
By the way, in all fairness to real hippies out there, I've sat through more than my share of boneheaded metalheads in movies. So fist bump to anybody who looks at this and goes, yeah, I find those people to be insufferable as well.
Well, also remember,
I've sat through many, many movies of like, oh, look, it's the metalhead. Here we go. Oh,
yeah. In the world of pop culture, again, of just like my grandparents or my parents in like Texas, right? You know, then you've got this gradations of countercultures, and the hippies are the people who went to Woodstock and basically just had a good time and got laid and smoked weed and that was okay. And the bikers, remember Altamont happened in 69 and that went to shit because of the Hells Angels. And so there's this popular reading of all of this. Okay. I'm not talking about the actual whatever the hell actually happened at Altamont. This is the way people read it. So when you get to something like this, you definitely, it's like, those guys are scary. That guy, you know, Bill Ewing as Pico, he's just some kid from my neighborhood who, like, has decided that this is a way to score chicks and
be far out, man.
And be far out. And I'm like, Roger Ebert reviewed this movie in 1972, and he said it's a wonderful review. So I don't want to steal his jokes, so you should read it. But one of the things that he said that I thought was wonderful was that all of the hippies in this movie talk like they've never said these words before in their lives. He said it's like if you tried to cast Frankie Avalon as a hippie and told him to say a lot of stuff like, and this is an actual quote from this movie, don't split, man, we groove on what you say when he shows up.
It's like the meme, you know, what's up, young kid?
Yes, what's up, fellow kids?
Yeah, hello young people.
Yeah, hello my
Steven, groovy Steve, hippie. Steve Buscemi. Yeah, Steve Buscemi. Yeah.
But this is a, you know,
let us
honestly,
all groove, can we?
Yeah. This is a Jason movie, right? There are certain ones that you can just see like are on a canister that says, well, Jason will like this. And anything where like this, and we watched the one with Frankie Avalon, Horror House, which was very similar. Anything where they're trying to present the culture of the 60s to capture it on film, I am all over that. Just I just love it. I watch it with wide eyes through the whole thing. And I always will. I'm also fascinated by anything from this era of like 1972, because you can't escape, in the same way that in the late 70s and the 80s you couldn't escape Vietnam. Vietnam hasn't ended in 1972, won't end until 1975, so that long national nightmare is only being thought of in terms of the peace movement at this point. Mm-hmm. So Vietnam is not really deeply imprinted here, except for the importance of the hippies. But Manson is like a deep hoofprint on this movie, you know, because the Tate LaBianca murders happened in 1969. So that's just like yesterday, right? I mean, that's as recent as the Will Smith slap, you know, and so there, it's on people's mind. And so after they made Count Yorga, now you've got some people who said, hey, how about if we took Count Yorga and we did a very similar movie, but instead of him moving in, and this is us getting started, instead of Count Yorga moving into middle class Los Angeles and dealing with doctors and lawyers, how about if instead Count Yorga is Manson? And he swoops in and he brings hippies under his wing. And I sort of like this concept that this vampire sort of reinvents himself. In my head canon, this is Count Yorga. It's just literally the same vampire.
Newman agrees with you.
Oh, like, yeah.
He in the Anno Dracula series, he has Count Yorga as a reoccurring lieutenant of Dracula, and in one of the novels that is set takes place in California, they run across this cult, and of course it's just Count Yorga in hippie drag, and I
if that's the case.
Yeah, I get the impulse of that, and I do think because the vampire just sort of shows up, like there's never really like the one hippie kind of summons him from the sea. I do think that it might work better if this was a sequel, but I will say that the character, like Count Yorga, is very much a classic movie vampire in the vein of Bela Lugosi and Christopher Lee. Right. Like he is that kind of vampire. The vampire that's in this is fair. Like I said, credit to Robert Quarry. Like it's a fairly distinct character. It doesn't just feel like they put a new coat of paint on Count Yorga. Like I was expecting him to be more Count Yorga-like because of everything I had ever heard about this movie. And, you know, I he's not that. Like, he's you're very much correct. Like, he is the specter of the Manson killings.
And yeah, but with way more just guru claptrap.
Yes.
Oh, and he's like, totally guru goofy.
Claptrap drives me nuts too, but I mean, that's what he's supposed to do.
Interestingly enough, Corey, a lot of so Corey, we should talk about this first, and then we'll get back to working through the plot, because I want to talk about him washing up in the ocean. But talking about Corey first as this vampire, I don't remember. We did Yorga probably in like our first year of doing the show, so it's been a
while.
No. It was late.
You don't think so? Yeah. Well, anyway, it was a long time ago, though. It has. I swear to you, it's been years since
yeah. It's been years.
It's nebulous now, but it was sooner. It was more recent than you think, I okay. believe.
All right, fair. What I do remember is that Count Yorga was a Hugh Hefner Bela Lugosi. I mean, he wore that smoking jacket and all that stuff.
Yeah, but he was way more violent, man. He would.
Oh yeah,
people up and choke people at the
get up and run and choke.
Yeah.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh baby, Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yes, right. The running
like, this guy is not that. That's where I'm kind of like, I get it, but also like this smooth guru guy is not.
He does have the same
joke guy.
He does have the same teeth. He literally has the same teeth that
and
he wore.
Those teeth are so scary.
Yeah.
They are so scary. But they were made for him by a dentist for Yorga, and he's just like, I'm keeping these. And no wonder. And his teeth look so different and so much better than everybody else. Everybody else looks like they got those plastic teeth that you get at the store on Halloween.
Line. Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of one thing that he does in Yorga and in this movie, where he's called Korda. But again, there's no. You know, if you're going to headcanon, it's Yorga, he could lie, man. This guy is not a very nice person. But he has all these monologues where he talks about immortality and the meaning.
Well, apparently
he
improvised those.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Apparently Robert Quarry basically improvised a lot of these sort of vampire
spiritual
philosophy things.
That makes sense. Like, because there's a certain stream of consciousness.
Yes.
Vibe to a lot of the things that he's saying.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that you can't squint and make him Yorga.
Yeah.
And far be it for me to disagree with you or Kim Newman, Jason.
No.
I'm just saying acting wise, I do think Robert Quarry does a very good job of even though he's playing a vampire in a contemporary setting yet again, like
yes.
He does a very good job of differentiating the two characters. Like he doesn't look like Count Yorga. Like Count Yorga was very much like that sort of suave, older gentleman, he had the smoking jacket and he had a cape and, it was all very like upper crust. And, this guy, he sort of floats around through the whole movie,
Well, like I mean, it's like I say, even if we ignored completely whether it was the same character or not, in this universe, the way vampires seem to operate is that they become sort of what this community really wants to see. So like, here in Topanga Canyon, he has decided he's going to amass himself a bunch of hippies. And so what does he appear as? He appears as a long-haired guru who says he's going to show them new ways to eat and new ways to learn and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they all want to turn on, right? So he's there to do that. That's just fascinating to me. I mean, that's a fascinating concept of a vampire, like that a vampire will morph itself to just lodge itself into wherever you are.
I would love to see an episode of What We Do in the Shadows where Matt Berry, it is a flashback, and Matt Berry is this.
Oh my God.
Laszlo as this guru would be amazing.
Matt Berry would be so perfect with the long beard.
I honestly think you could remake this movie fairly well. You know, like make some of the changes that we have kicked around here. And, you know, like where this movie could have gone from being kind of funny and kitschy to being something like a little better if you just tweaked a few things here and there.
There's a lot. I mean, I will go back to and apologize that it's disingenuous to wish to go, well, if I were doing the movie, it would be so much better, blah, right? Like we are here to talk about the movie as it is. And so we can, you know, it's cool to talk about our wishes, but like, I think there's a lot. I think you're right that there's a kernel of a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah.
For me, maybe it didn't all gel, but you know, even down to the kind of nihilistic ending that we'll get to kind of.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff that maybe just didn't quite come together, but it's still entertaining. So I'm with you.
There's also a problem if you're watching this movie, and it may be that in a drive-in where you're just sort of captured, it would be let. But it's difficult to watch this movie, you know, on YouTube, by the way, which is the only way you can get it unless you find the Retromedia DVD, which is I think maybe out of print, but it can be difficult to sit through because it does have some drag. It kind of gets a little repetitive in the second half, but I want to go back to the beginning. What's interesting here is we watched a movie called Lips of Blood, and that movie ended with the vampire and the vampire's lover getting into a coffin and the surf takes them away. And this is a movie where the surf brings the vampire to the shore. And I just found it fascinating, a weird coincidence that there are two movies where the vampire is moving from place to place with the tide, you know, in a wooden coffin. It's a strange concept, and it was strange to see it like pop up twice. But yeah.
How cool would it be to leave a beach party where you hop in a coffin and just get carried out to sea? Bye, everybody. And then you just get in your coffin and it floats out.
Well, the hilarious thing is you would have to get in your coffin and then wait for the tide to come in.
Well, idea being at night, hopefully the tide like be somewhere. But I think that would be the best exit to a party.
Yes. No, it really.
Hi, everybody. Really, I'm hopping in my coffin. Certainly memorable.
Jaws begins with the girl going skinny dipping and she gets bitten by a shark. It just occurs to me that she could have run into Yorga's coffin.
I want to see that movie too. I don't want to talk too much about movies I would like this to be, but that would be awesome. Yeah.
A surfer dude who is not a hippie and not a biker, a surfer, finds the coffin and opens it up and checks it out. And then our Renfield character, who will stay for the rest of the film,
Barbado.
A very tall dude called Barbado chokes the surfer to death.
Straight up. Yes. I mean, this is
one thing I love about this movie is that Barbado and Count Yorga both have their own music that they come in with. So every time Barbado enters a room or enters a shot, he has these shell chimes that play. And then every time the guru enters, he's got sitar music playing, which I think is really, really cool.
Oh, man.
He chokes the hippie to death. Rude.
This familiar, though, he is a TCB. I mean, not so great about not leaving a trail from the dead surfer because he just drags.
That's a good point.
Like, where did he get? Well, here's the part where he drug something. Like, there's obvious. But boy, like, that's awesome. He just comes in. No, I'll be taking that coffin, surfer guy. And then,
he's always like that. He's always very silent and creepy. And yet, for some reason, What's his name? What's the hippie, the hippie hero's name?
It's Pico.
Pico. For some reason, Pico at one point is like, what's wrong with you, man? Why aren't you talking? I'm like, he's never talked. He's always looked exactly like this. Why are you thinking he should be any
Because obviously at one point he, like, we have to assume that prior to the movie starting that he was more normal.
Oh, I never thought about that.
Part of their world already?
I never thought about that.
I think he was part of their, I took it as that he was part of their friend group. And
I didn't think that at all. I thought he was just like, oh, I need to show up because the master's coming home and
But Drew's an interesting one.
I don't think that he worked for the vampire prior to the start of this movie. I think that
the familiar.
I think he was a hippie that was into the occult and you know, he was gonna summon a vampire, and you know, he summoned him from the sea. I think we're thinking about this. I think we're more thinking about this than the screenwriters probably.
Yeah,
that's very.
I will say this about this character, and this is me, you know, kind of coming at this with a 20th century or 21st century lens, the way you know we often do with these things. I do find myself a little troubled that the Renfield character is a mute, subservient person of color. It doesn't quite play as campy fun as some of the other stuff in the movie. And again, I know that, you know, this was the 70s, you know, cultural sensitivities were different than what they are, so I'm not, you know, judging the movie too harshly, but like, you know, it is something I thought about while watching it.
I totally get where you're coming from, and I also think they were thinking like, well, what if it's kind of voodoo-y, right?
Yeah,
and that's totally really where they were heading with it. But whether that's a good idea or not is totally different. But he isn't but regardless, he is imposing as hell. And all about doing vampire dirty deeds.
Yes.
And he plays a mean lute.
Yes. He does.
Yeah.
I have to say, just on the music thing real quick before you go off to a different topic, Jason. So when the hippies are at the castle and they're just like sitting around and the one guy is playing the guitar, you know, he's playing that Scarborough Fairish song. Apparently that song is actually written, it's called The Man Without a Vision. It's actually written by Ray Conniff.
Yeah.
And it's the lyrics are partly written by Bobby Pickett.
It gets better. Bobby Pickett is the dude playing the guitar. That's the crazy thing is Boris Pickett. This, first of all, I know zero things, nothing about Boris Pickett. I interrupted your flow though.
No, that's right. So Bobby Pickett is in the movie. I guess he's the guy playing the guitar, like you say. And then you said that he wrote or he sang Monster Mash.
That's right. He co-wrote it, and he was 24 years old when he did that, which also blows my mind. You know, there's nothing about Bobby Boris Pickett and the way he sang that doing a Boris Karloff impression that made me think this was a 24-year-old.
Yeah, sorry.
So that's so weird. But actually, that's another interesting thing is there are some great names in this movie. I mean, because, you know, you mentioned Ray Conniff, who was this very, very popular band leader and composer. He did a lot of movies. He wrote a lot of pop orchestrations. He did a lot of TV music. I mean, this was as recognizable a composer, you know, short of like Mancini, as you could get in the mid-century. And so he's working on this movie. That guy who plays Pop,
John Fiedler, from the Bob Newhart Show, is where I knew him from.
Bob Newhart Show. He's the voice of Piglet. He's I remember him from Harper Valley PTA. Anyway, these are like recognizable people.
Yeah.
sort of on the periphery of this weird little film that is not available anywhere.
I like the Pop's character too. It's very
he's great.
He's just like, I want the best for all my hippie friends. Yeah.
What'd you say, Drew?
I said Pop's to me was the most actually likable character in the movie.
Yes.
I'm with you.
Yeah. Well, and Pop, just for the listener, if you haven't seen it and you want to listen to this before you watch it. So Pop is this middle-aged dude who lives in Topanga Canyon where all of our characters are hanging out. And he runs a, you know, kind of a head shop, curio shop,
he makes jewelry.
Bookstore, jewelry. Yeah. I mean, you know, and he charges a pretty penny for all of his pieces, but you know, he just runs this shop that is frequented by everyone. And you kind of get the impression, you know, what a great life this guy's had. Like, you know, like we don't know what he is, but in my mind, he probably had a pretty straight life, like as a teacher or something. And he's retired and he's running the shop and probably having the best time of his life.
Yeah. He's got kind of hippie duds, but he's kind of the caretaker. I mean, the reason he's Pops is because everybody kind of defers to him and looks at, like, they're helping him when he's at he's got like a stand. And you know, everybody's helping him and he cares for all of these people, like he knows them, and you get the idea that he's kind of the rock of the hippie community
of this community.
I think that's cool, and also him being such a recognizable character actor from the time.
Yes,
like if you watched a bunch of movies and kind of where he's recognizable, and that was kind of, oh, look, you know,
yeah, it's that guy. Yeah, yeah. When Barbado finds the vampire, and Drew's exactly right. Barbado, in a sense, you can think of him as a lighthouse for this coffin to come towards. But regardless, Barbado is playing his flute, and it brings, you know, the coffin into the beach where he is. And he carries Corda off. You know, Corda's in the coffin. He carries Corda off, I guess, into the woods. And then Corda, almost that very night, makes his appearance in this hippie commune,
and he puts him in his truck and like drives him to the
mansion. That's right.
Yeah, he's well prepared. He's ready to.
That's right. That's right. He has the truck.
He appears suddenly among the hippies, and I don't feel like they actually were put off by the fact that suddenly there's another person.
No,
there.
It's really wild.
They're always welcoming people.
It's actually very well done in the movie, because I was watching this movie, you know, and I thought I was paying attention. And then, you know, and the hippies are doing their groovy thing and they're talking. And then all of a sudden, Corda is just sitting among them and says something that makes all of their ears perk up. And I was like, when did he get there? I mean, it's just very well done. You know,
and then when he walks away, he vanishes. He like disappears like a ghost. Which
yes.
Super weird. And it was so disappointing because he walks off and disappears, and then Barbado walks after him and then just keeps walking down the hall. And I'm like, oh man, I was really hoping Barbado would disappear too.
Yeah. That is the scene, by the way, where the, you know, Corda shows up and he says, I don't even remember, because it's impossible, to Drew's point, it's very stream of consciousness. I don't remember the clever things that Corda has to say, other than, you know, there are ways that we can live better. And he tries to get them to take on an organic diet and no more alcohol. And,
well,
you know,
I will say
a living diet, which is not necessarily
right.
If I ever meet any more Cordis, and I've met similar people at a party, I just want to leave, or I want to get as far away from those cats as possible every time. It's like, oh,
you know, the thing that I think is kind of cool about the whole thing about the diet is that, you know, I'm, you know, as a former butcher, it makes me think about, like, you know, types of beef where, like, the cow is fed a particular diet to get a certain kind of flavor, right. And that's sort of what this vampire guru is doing now, is like he wants them to have
taste good.
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't mean specifically the diet part. I mean just his whole mannerism.
Yes.
Like somebody I don't want to be around.
No,
but it's
yeah.
a good point that Drew makes, that he's just trying to make the people taste better.
But that's cool. That's interesting. What I mean is just his whole demeanor and character are, I, as I was watching this movie, like, I want to, I've met a couple cats like similar, and I want to just not be around them.
Well, there is one. There is one of the character, the biker character, Mike, who's fallen in with the hippies, but is a biker. He from jump has no time for Corda. He's like, man. This guy's full of shit. I'm not interested in his,
his
weird preaching, you know. Because what happens next, before Mike finally just splits, Mike comes by and Corda has taken all the hippies. He's basically said, this is my mansion now. And also, it's time for a montage. All of you people need to be cheerily painting and washing the windows and stuff like that. And they're all doing it. So this is the moment when we really get to see Corda as a cult leader, and not even necessarily a dangerous one yet. Just a cult leader. They're all like, Corda said, wash the windows.
Cult leaders start out not dangerous. They always start out not dangerous. That's how they get everybody.
I mean, they are actually, but
No, but I mean the appearance wise. They seem to be like, you know, you step in and they're like, you're going to be the best version of yourself. And you're like, yeah.
Yes.
The he splits when his girlfriend spurns him, right? Like that was the...
Well, he finally gets sick of... It's the evening later, and they're all eating their boiled vegetables or whatever it is that they eat, and they're singing their songs. And his girlfriend is just hanging out. And he goes, I am sick of this. I'm sick of your stupid food. And Drew... What is it that he says?
I want to go into town for some steak and some whiskey. And see, I love the idea that there's this character that sees through the party line here, just with this sort of Zen cynicism.
Yeah,
you know, that speaks to me very much as a human being, which I would have loved if this guy had been our point of view.
Oh, you're so right. You know? You're so right. Like, yeah.
It was, oh my but gosh. I mean, I get why you're not going to do that in a 1970s movie. You know, you're going to want to try to, you know, make your main character. You know, the hero that we get is very much like a zeitgeist kind of character. He does martial arts. He's got long hair. You know, like he is very much a protagonist.
Hey, guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun, too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Of the time.
He's very influenced by Billy Jack. Like 1971 was Billy Jack. So right before this, right? Like just that moment, you get the impression they're like, what do we do with this character? I was like, well, what if we just make it Billy Jack? Like he does kung fu. He's got Indian stuff. You know, and oh my God, pure exploitation, by the way. But yes, you know,
I mean, like,
this is what people are gonna dig.
That's, I mean, I have no problem with that, right? Like, right. We watch enough B and down to films.
What if they had just continued? Because, like, you know, the biker guy, they kill him off very quickly, but like, if Tony already kind of hit on this, like, if you watch the opening part of the movie, it does sort of feel like that this character is going to be a more important character. And, you know, even if they had just like kept the two of them as like a vampire hunting duo that are kind of opposites in some way. Like, you know, like, and yeah, I understand I am reviewing the movie that I would have rather watched instead of the movie that I did watch. And I, you know, I can't help that, you know, to a degree. Like, you know, like I do have a tendency when I'm watching movies in film critic mode, which is different than when I'm just watching a movie as entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, I do tend to do a little mental rewriting to go, okay, well, this would have been more interesting to me, but you know,
it could have used some reorganizing. And I think it's one of the dangers of it as a horror movie is that they've got to kill people. They do kill Mike way too soon. You know, it doesn't serve any purpose to have him die. He should stick around, because the curious thing is, who's taking up the space of the scenes once Pico decides I'm splitting and I'm bringing help? now you have to introduce new cops and new, like you got to do all this stuff to refill the frame when you could have had Mike.
Well, I think it's to kind of get rid of, you know, in with the plot, it makes sense that Cord is like, well, he's going to be the sticky, you know, wicket here. He's going to not, it's, I need to get rid of this guy because he's not falling for any of my crap.
Yeah.
So,
although by killing him, he does sort of, you know, there is then also the question, hey, where did Mike go? Like,
right.
Why did Mike never come back from town?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
like,
but in the era,
they're already being damped by that point.
Right, yeah, but in the era, a missing hippie or a missing biker, either way, not a big deal to the cops, to the heat.
Well, I mean, more to Pico.
No, but they don't care. They're not going to care about him because he was never really part of them anyway. He just came.
Well, he does at one point. He does finally ask the question, you know, hey, where is Mike? And he goes and, you know, like that's one of the things he gets the cops. And I'm not saying that the cops would necessarily care about this like transient guy, but, you know, within, you know, the way our protagonist reacts to it,
and he just gets found by chance.
Question mark. Yep. Yeah.
I want to skip to the curious thing where Pico, I can't really, you can tell me in a second because I don't want to answer this question just yet. Pico decides he needs to go and bring the police to investigate Corda. But when they come back, when the police show up the first time to face Corda, and this is very similar to a scene in Count Yorga, Corda has all of the hippies doing interpretive dance. Oh my God, thank God that this scene exists.
That was
such
a fun scene.
There are
really
so many things.
That.
Yes. Oh, it's so great. All of these actors are just sort of spinning their faces in sort of like a blissed out thing while they do their pirouettes and whatever. It is so weird and great.
Like dancey yoga.
Right. Fabulous. You know, and it also, sir, it's, I mean, you can see, like, if Will Ferrell were playing Corda, how this could be an absolutely hilarious film.
That would be great. I want a remake with Will Ferrell as the guru.
It's pretty funny already, even.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. You know, think back. If I'm a 22-year-old, you know, in the audience at a drive-in, am I supposed to think this is goofy or disturbing? I'm never quite sure what you're supposed to think.
You know, I don't think this is, again, another one of those things. I don't think that the people who made this thought of it as, intentionally funny. Like I think that they were trying to just make an exploitation movie, and they're like, oh, what are things that hippies do? Oh, well, they do weird dances and you know, they eat weird food and, you know, like that kind of thing, and
you say blissed out stuff.
So I don't really think that they were thinking that deeply about it. You know, I think they thought, well, whatever people think about this whenever they've seen it, well, we got their money by then, so who cares,
right? The and my dad has commented actually that they half the time weren't really paying. I think producers were aware that the audience is really only half paying attention anyway. So it's just the nature of the drive. We are paying way more attention to these movies than the regular Friday night crowd would be paying attention to them. Okay, so interpretive dancing. What happens next is until we get to the, so I don't want to like spend too much time on the plot of, because what happens next is a lot of moving back and forth through the tunnels chasing one another. This movie becomes very repetitive for like half an hour of the characters just sort of locked in a sort of cat and mouse game where Pico and Pop are trying to discover, you know, the secrets of Corda. And they're moving through this really amazing set that if anybody listening to this can identify this for real for us, let us know. because I don't know if these tunnels are like winery tunnels or I don't know what these are, but you know, they're separated out by these anti-flooding doors.
Cellar, you mean? But yeah. No, I know. It was really interesting where they have these like submarine type doors.
Wild. Clearly not built for this movie. I mean, it's a practical set of some kind. So I would love to know, are they really underneath this castle Las Feliz castle that they're filming in, or is it somewhere else in, you know, around Topanga Canyon? I just want to know. Anyway, eventually, you get to an ending that is, again, very, very much like, the Count Yorga films, where you have, you know, the death of Yorga. This is disappointing. So Pico thinks that he's going to stab Corda, and very depressingly, he instead accidentally stabs Pop. I don't understand exactly how this happened. I mean, he literally...
Yeah, I don't know why Pop was in the coffin. That was weird.
Pico stabs a stake into a wooden coffin without opening it. And I've seen that before, and maybe that's fine. But it turns out that Pop had been put in the coffin. But Pop must have been already pretty much dead, because why would Pop be just laying in a coffin? That doesn't necessarily, you know, whatever. But
well, he wasn't dead because he does yell,
he does
yell
scream.
Out.
So who knows? Anyway, that's very sad because we love that character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But after that, Corda attacks Pico and we have our final fight. Whoa. And then Corda dies. Yeah, go ahead.
I thought, am I remembering correctly? Doesn't he confronts Corda, and that was the deal.
Well, that's... No. So he comes in, he stabs the coffin, and then he opens the coffin and he realizes he stabbed Pop.
No.
And then Corda comes out.
Oh, how did Pop get in?
I have no memory. Deal was there
maybe
was
they
thing
cut that,
where...
Maybe they cut that from what the version we watched. I don't know.
No, because we watched the same one that Tony did, but I don't remember Pop facing off alone, but maybe he did. Yeah.
The guru vampire is like, haha, got you, that was funny, you stabbed that guy and you thought it was me, and then they have this dumbest fight, and then Pico jumps out of the way, or like rolls out of the way, and the vampire impales himself on a piece of wood.
Yeah, that was kind of
it is deeply
super dumb.
Disappointing. There's a million things they could have done with no money. I don't know why they chose to do this.
I mean, they set up this whole kind of kung fu. Like I said, it seemed closer to jujitsu or something with more throws.
Mm-hmm.
because he's grappling. When we show him doing his martial arts, he's grappling a lot, right?
Good point. Yeah.
And there's a whole, he's set up a whole thing, like he could have grappled and thrown him or something. That was a whole, that's part of his character. And yet he just kind of goes, oh, and then I've fallen out the way. And then, you know, Corda impales himself, which is, I mean, I guess it kind of goes into what we kind of get is this nihilistic thing. Like, you know, you couldn't do anything really. It's chance in this world, but still give Pico something. I mean, he's been through the ringer. Give him a chance to do something good, but nope.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's a budget thing where literally they didn't have time to I don't know.
I mean, it's not like, come on. It's not like that fight at the beginning was super choreographed.
No, that's true.
He just ran at each other and he grappled him and, you know, hit him.
So I cannot, like, I have no excuse. I can't explain it at all. But what's interesting is the end after that, which is that once Corda is dead, all of the people that he's turned into vampires, and I've never seen this in a movie before, they all just poof, they turn into,
well, it's, you know, the whole idea, like, instead of, it's an interesting twist, because again, there's a lot of like good bits. So Pop, in addition to being this thing, he's also knows all this occult stuff, like he's got these books, so he's the reference. So when they're starting to do investigation and Pico's like, look, this is what I saw, and and Pop finally believes him, he's like, oh, well, according to this manuscript, the disciples wear these necklaces because so they can go out and so they can be daywalkers. That's kind of cool. And like Pop says this kind of,
that's a very
knowledge
good point.
As being, you know, the Giles of the movie. Kind of neat.
He's a regular hippie Van Helsing.
Yeah. Well, he's not really. He's just he's like I said, he's more.
No, but it's true. He can find that rune and everything. And by the way,
but you know, all of that stuff is fascinating, like, you know, the bit. So usually we'll get a thing, and that's one thing that's also this, it kind of has the horror short story nihilism that you kind of see in a lot of, like, where you get from, like, horror short story book, like book fair horror anthologies, where bad, like, it's just bad at the end, just mean and bad. I remember I had a couple of those. And so instead of kind of turning back into their normal selves, instead they're too far gone. That's it. Yeah. And that's, whoa, that was surprising. Super I will dark, say. Yeah.
No, you're right. It is kind of like the Buffy the Vampire Slayer concept, where once you're a vampire, you know, the soul is gone, the body is a corrupted thing. And so they will
poof, when you die into dust.
Yeah. Also, their hope, even when they're talking about it beforehand, their hope is they can catch everyone before they're too far gone. And yeah, we get the impression that that may not have ever been a possibility. Maybe. We don't know.
Yeah, because even his girlfriend,
yeah,
who didn't seem to be as far gone, still turns to dust.
Just that's, and that's slower. Like, oh, that was, you yeah, know, we end with him like yelling like, you know, kind of ash at the end. Like, ah. Like,
well, it was really dark, really dark ending.
Yeah, she, you know, she looks okay because she was part of the, and then begins to decay, which was kind of a cool effect. Again, that's, you know,
it was
well, put your money on that. That was kind of neat.
And that's sort of what puts this movie squarely into the 70s as opposed to like the 60s, because mm-hmm. like in the 70s we did start to get more into cynical, you know, endings, and you know Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where you, even though the heroine survives, she seems like she's lost her yes. damn mind. Or, you know, John Carpenter, of course, always likes to end his movies kind of ambiguously, and this feels very much like that. And mm-hmm. you know, I think even though we're dealing with hippies and this sort of love generation, you know, that kind of whole thing, like, you know, if this had been a 60s movie, I think it probably would have been a little bit more optimistic in the way it ended. But like this, you know, the fact that it does kind of get, you know, like punch you in the gut in the last few seconds, you know, that to me is more of a 70s kind of thing.
Yeah. I just wanted to mention, there's this scene when some of the vampires are coming to town to do basically errands, right, and to pick up stuff. This is just after Pop has figured out, you know, shown them the rune for them to be able to walk around. And as they're walking, you know, and we see them in town, Pico calls to them, they don't respond. But this is the part that is very very, very like Manson. You know, the whole concept of the Manson family, well, girls going into town and getting fruit and whatever the hell they needed to pick up, you know, and if you're watching it, I think in 72, that's going to pop into your head a lot because you've been watching all of those trials and stuff.
Go ahead. Not to be that guy, but that's Flick. He says, hey, they didn't talk to me in anything. Like, what was this symbol? I noticed they had the symbol.
Oh, you're right.
So yeah, that's right. The detective work comes after that, where they're like, it's like, I saw him in town. Nobody's talking to me. All my friends, you know.
No, you're exactly right. You're right.
In the castle, Pops, what's up? He's, well, there's this entry. Yeah. I mean, you know, some of it's a little pat as far as like, oh, well, here's some other stuff I found. But I think it's part of him being this touchstone and this, you know, cultural librarian of the group, you know.
Yeah,
keeping the, you know, you get the impression he's been keeping them out of trouble where he can for a while.
Yeah,
the fact that it also leads to his occult knowledge is kind of fascinating.
It's,
actually,
it's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, there's so many, like, what is the status of this movie? Is this movie in the public domain? Like, what is, like, what's the deal with it, you know?
I don't think it's in the public domain, because if it were, I think that we would see a bazillion burned, yeah, badly burned copies of it on DVD, right, at like HEB down the street.
That's a good point. Right. Yeah, I mean,
odd lots or whatever.
But there is a, let's see when that recent DVD came out. There's a DVD from Fred Olen Ray's company. It's not, doesn't say it's discontinued, but it's 21 years old, the last DVD. So, you know, I mean, And here's one that where it's bundled in with something else, and that's from 2008. This thing has not been printed in a long time. So obviously that's a rights issue. So it's not in the public domain. It's just, you know, God only knows who has the rights to this, which is weird. Well, anyway, that takes us.
Court is trying to keep the history down.
That's right.
He doesn't want you to know.
Right. It's the he wants to keep us away from the untold history of I want to see more Yorga identities. If Yorga is able to just reinvent himself over and over again for different groups, there are other things that he could be doing. You know, he could be in amongst a bunch of Nazis. He could be in amongst a bunch of like Black Panthers. I mean, he could be anywhere.
Yorga the cab driver.
I mean, he would look different too.
Good.
Yeah. All right. Let's get our final thoughts. And well, before I do that, I know I skipped over really the second half because I think it becomes kind of a munge, but we hit on a lot of it. Is there anything else that you'd like to call out before we move on to final thoughts? All right. Well, if anything comes up, you can bring it up. So Julia, what are your final thoughts on Korda, the Death Master?
So, you know, according to like Roger Ebert and other people, it's like, this movie was just them trying to, you know, have a tax write off and use up the contracts that on these people that they had or whatever. So, but I don't know. I mean, even despite that, and despite the fact that it was made in like 17 days, I think it has a lot going for it. I think it's actually entertaining and there's some really cool stuff. Like I say, I like the music and the score and the weird choices that they make for the soundtrack, and I love the clothing, I love the set, so it's not a terrible movie. I mean, it's really, we've definitely watched worse ones.
Yes.
But you know, yeah, it's like I think more than anything, I think the part that disappointed me the most was just how the vampire gets beat, you know, gets defeated. But yeah. Other than that, you know, I think it's fine. It's just, you know, there's some silly parts and whatever, but it's not. I enjoyed it. I thought it was entertaining.
Excellent. Who do we, Tony, what about you?
Yeah, I think it's a solid, you know, B movie. I guess I still feel like it kind of fits in that TV movie vibe, but I like that aesthetic as well in some ways. I definitely don't mean that.
Say more about that. Like what makes the score and the
pacing and how it's kind of cut, the way I don't know, there's multiple just things in the presentation and the way it's put together, and the flavor of the you know, how it's filmed as well in some way. And again, yeah. I really don't mean that as a bad thing.
No,
but it just has a vibe, and it's a vibe I enjoy. So it's just interesting that,
well, visually,
to me, it's interesting in that there is a certain way you film a movie and how it's portrayed that gives it that feeling, and I find it fascinating when I find a movie that kind of feels that way but wasn't, you know.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what there are lots of things that would make it have that particular effect, but one of them is just, to me, the background. I mean, when you think about it, Tony, mm-hmm. the way this movie looks, especially in those hills, in that particular yeah. sun, you know, those particular trees, it looks, you know, that there was a
and how we're even the introductions, like how we are introduced, like the cuts from the bikers to the hippies.
Yes.
So all of yes. that just has the, and the, like I said, the way that the pacing is done act to act and yeah. scene to scene.
It could easily be a TV movie.
It goes into the montage. Right. It goes yeah. like, it just has that flow, which yeah. I think is interesting when you find that out. But I think there's, I mean, the nihilism on display by the end.
Yes.
And, you know, this idea of vampire as cult leader is really interesting. I think it's, you know, kind of fast. It's fascinating that it's so far out of print. The only way to catch it is YouTube. It's, I mean, I think this would do kind of well on Shudder, just as a,
it's a really good point.
But like, I mean, there's obvious reasons why it's not there, right? Probably, like you said, rights issues. It's, yeah. you know, I would guess that, again, it's music rights issues, which tend to gum up the works. And I'm all about musicians getting paid, right? Like, sure. don't get me wrong. I'm like, oh, why are they greedy or whatever? But if I had to guess, when you see credits that say these themes by these people,
yeah,
it's more likely.
Well, especially since it's Ray Conniff, so it's a major
right,
player.
Exactly, exactly. You know? And that's when I see those things, I tend to say, you know, the clearance is just not worth it for the people who would want to. I want to put out this DVD. Well, we got to clear the music rights this way. I'm fully invested in musicians getting their worth, right? But sometimes, you know, for better or worse, that can get in the way of how much people want to invest in a, especially something that's a B movie that, you know, what's the actual interest? How many copies are you going to move? Which it sucks that we have to think of commercial art that way, but that's just the way it is.
Let me ask a practical question before we move on to Drew. If I have a movie like this, you know, I'm a just DVD distributor or a video on demand distributor, and I acquire a movie like this, but I got to clear these music rights. Mm-hmm. How much work is it for me instead to go just cut the music, replace it with library music?
Well, I mean, they did that for what, WKRP for a while.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. I don't remember, but I'm sure that's the case.
I mean, it's not. I mean, again, how much investment do you want to? Well, also, you have to balance that too, right? Like for years, people were like, also, I hate these DVDs or I hate this release because it doesn't have the original music.
Yeah.
So if you were going to present a movie like where there's X amount of cult, well, it has a cult following, right?
Yeah.
Is a cut release where you cut the songs going to be reviled and therefore you're stuck with thousands of copies just sitting in a warehouse because people got wind that you made changes?
Yeah.
And those are the things you have to think about as a distributor.
Yeah.
So you might go, look, we just couldn't get the rights. They did, you know, that happened with one of the Gundam. Mm. There was a Neil Sedaka, like,
intro. Really? Huh.
Like, he did the intro, but it was only like, you know, it was licensed in Japan. So when it came to, I think it was Neil Sedaka, I'm pretty sure. But when it came to outside of Japan, they needed to get the clearance.
Yeah.
And they just didn't feel like it was worth it. And it was during the intro. So they made a different one, and people, you know, I wanted to see the original intro. I mean, luckily we live in a world where there's YouTube, so somebody's uploaded it, right?
Yes.
But those are the kinds of choices. But where you have things that are in the film and you want to replace it, it gets a little dicier because then you got to, you know, in a better world, you would match lips and all of that, right? So you got to come up with a better way. You don't want to cut the film, especially if people are like, I want a Death Master. It depends on how, you know, you have to balance that. Like, am I going to
I'm just wondering
what they want or not?
You brought up what the risks are, but I'm just wondering, like, is it, it seems like just practically, you also have to hire not cheap engineers to go in and mess with the sound to begin with, you know?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
And that's a far cry from, I just bought this movie and I'm just going to digitize it and put it out. Now, all of a sudden, I've got to spend easily thousands and thousands of dollars, you know?
You'll see it happen. Yeah. Look at all the video releases of Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
We only just recently, in the past few years, outside of VHS, we just recently got a Blu-ray, mm-hmm. where you can select a version that has original audio intact, etc., right?
Yeah.
And it was determined that it was more important to have a DVD release. Same with, oddly enough, The Hobbit on DVD has sound effects. Mm. The music's all intact, but sound effects are missing and stuff because of the mastering or however that was.
Huh.
So, like, you, again, as a distributor, you have to make those choices. And that's where you run into, you know, is it going to be okay enough, or the vocal minority of fans who really want this cult classic going to give it a pass?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I don't know.
That's a good point. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Drew, what are your thoughts coming back to the film as opposed to the distribution of the film?
Well, first off, I mean, just to dovetail on this, like, it seems to me that somebody should get the rights to the two Yorga movies and this movie and just do a box set.
Absolutely.
Like, I, you know, it's kind of crazy to me that, like, Scream Factory or Vinegar Syndrome or, you know, one of those hasn't done that, because at the very least is something adjacent to two more slightly more popular movies.
Yeah.
You know, this would be worth an inclusion in that. Well, but
there's a Yorga, there's a dual disc Yorga set.
Yes.
But does
I
it have
think I was,
it doesn't
have this one, I think no. I thought I saw somebody talking about the commentary where it talked about this movie.
I have a memory of that as well.
And I think that you'll get information if you get that Yorga set. Oh, they made a really nice limited edition too. I think there's discussion about it if I remember correctly, but it's been a bit since I've looked at that set.
Here I'm sitting, 2023, would plunk down good money
for a
box set with those three movies.
Arrow's the last distributor to put that out, so it would have to be an Arrow's court to.
If for whatever reason one of those, you know, the execs from Arrow is listening to this podcast, you know, you have at least one customer here.
Yeah, for sure.
The movie itself, you know, it's not perfect. It's not an amazing film, but it's fun. And, you know, I watch, for what it's worth, like I watched this on a day where I had a migraine and I was laid up in bed and I watched horror movies pretty much the whole day. And, you know, this was one of the ones that stuck with me after, you know, I went back to business as usual. And I thought it was a good, because I thought it was a good time, you know, like, and sometimes that's all you need. I kind of poked a lot of holes in it, but like that's the job when you're analyzing a movie to a degree.
Absolutely. And it certainly doesn't keep you from watching it again, that's for sure.
No, I totally would. Like, yeah. if somebody were to say, like, hey, you know, want to throw a vampire movie on, and I were to say, okay, let's do Death Master, I would eagerly watch, because I think this would be the sort of movie that would be a good time, like if you had like a room full of people and some pizza and you know, like it would be a good horror movie party movie. And anybody who watches a lot of horror movies, like, they know exactly what I'm talking about. So you know, this is that. And, you know, I don't think it's quite as much fun as Yorga, but, you know, it is still a good time.
You know, if I were to do my typical movie party idea, I think I would do this, Race with the Devil, and Devil's Reign.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good,
like,
triple
feature. Like the through line of the kind of nihilism and culty stuff, I think. You can add a York movie, but I think that would be the trilogy that I would show, just for some just different textures, right?
Race with the Devil is a really, I mean, you could also, I think, do, like, you could do horror movies that take place, like, around Topanga Canyon. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that would capture, like, you know, you could do, like, The Girl in the Empty Grave, which is admittedly is more of a mystery than a horror, but there's, we could probably pull together, that one with Linda Blair where she rides horses and there's the devil, the witch who has infiltrated her family. Summer of Fear, which is a Wes Craven movie. That also is shot in Topanga Canyon. So we need one more to make a nice triple feature. But there's probably some.
Well,
great,
and what's
canyon
the one
horror.
That what's the one that that is also shot there, was the creature. Let's see. I'm looking at the trivia to see, because it was in the IMDb trivia.
Oh, Ebert thought that they had filmed Crab Monsters.
Yeah, could that one.
But he was talking about the Santa Monica Beach where
Attack of the Crab Monsters. What makes you think it's not that?
It may very well be. But that's at the beach. I'm just talking about this inland filming, you know, inside the, you know, in the canyon, although it's next to the beach, so yeah, sure. But excellent point. All right, that's probably enough discussion of Death Master, but boy, I'm so happy that we watched that. Thank you very much for indulging me on that one, as we make our way through a bunch of vampire movies that are more or less unconnected from one another, which is super exciting. Let's get our endorsements. Like, what have you been listening to that you want, or watching or reading that you want to share? Starting with Julia, do you have anything for us?
Sure. We went to see Operation Fortune, Ruse de Guerre at the AMC Theater, and it is a Guy Ritchie film with Jason Statham and Hugh Grant and Aubrey Plaza and Cary Elwes. It's really fun. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a lot of fun. Just as a kind of, I don't know, what would you say the genre is, Jason? Well, it's a Guy Ritchie film.
I mean, it's basically, it's Guy Ritchie, but it's genre. Not like a Guy Ritchie crime film. It's more like a Guy Ritchie British Mission Impossible movie.
Yeah.
And it's
good. Amusing. Yeah. It was a fun watch. And then I watched a movie on Netflix called We Have a Ghost with Anthony Mackie and David Harbour. And that was a really fun movie. That was more of a cute, like,
I was surprised.
Almost like a family film. It was really, really cute. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought David Harbour was great as a silent ghost. it was a fun film. So if you're looking, you know, if you're just on Netflix, it's definitely worth just having on. But I spent the last few weeks obsessed with the Alex Murdaugh trial, so now I don't know what I'm gonna be playing in the background of my life. We'll see what next week brings.
Excellent. Tony, what about you?
I've been watching a bunch of stuff because we took kind of a break. I have been really enjoying this season of the Wu-Tang Clan series, which is just excellent series. If you like biopic, you know, music biopic series, it's great. Poker Face continues to be amazing. Really stoked about that. The one I recommend that's kind of, this is a recommendation that I really enjoy. Fantastic Fest favorite. I got a screener and it's out on VOD now. And I need to post all the links on our socials. So Jason, I need to get all these up. But FP4 Ebbs. The FP is a crass, really fun, in my opinion. This is a movie. I like the absurdity of it. This may not be for everyone. And I hate the filmmakers, I hope don't mind me saying that the film is not for everyone, but if you love absurdity, it's a post-apocalyptic world where a version of Dance Dance Revolution is how people settle their differences. Extremely profane, by the way, and filmed in Fraser Park, and they have this like kind of new apocalyptic kind of also kind of white trash lingo that goes throughout it, but this is the fourth one in the series. FP4 Ebbs, and they filmed it a lot on green screens. It's like, it's interesting that they've made it more and more digital, both for filmmaking purposes and budgetary, you know, purposes. But I did get a screener link from XYZ, and I needed to put it up, but I wanted to make sure it was an endorsement. If you like the previous FP films, in my opinion, you're getting more of this kind of just crazy vision. And you're kind of along for the ride or not, you know? But I had a lot of fun. The filmmakers are really cool. I've met them several times at Fantastic Fest. And I think if you're down for just insane pastiche of video games and just bizarre stuff, FP4 Ebbs has you covered. I really enjoy it. But I don't know if everyone... I think even diehard fans, I don't know, you take these at drones, but I recommend it. And I have had a blast with these films. I'm also playing the new Yakuza game, which takes place in feudal Japan, but has, in the same way that they also did a Fist of the North Star Yakuza game, they have, this is a remake of one, but it's an updated version. Oh, and speaking of Fist of the North Star, there's also Fist of the North Star, Jason, you might be fascinated by this. Fist of the North Star Fitness Boxing, where it's the Switch. So you have, you know, you hold the controllers in your hand, you box.
Oh, man, that's
but you're cool. Punching fist, you know, it's post-apocalyptic boxing, which, by the way, all these things are very.
That sounds great.
Laser focused to Tony, I think. I mean, obviously other people, but if you have a Switch and and it teaches you like the stance, boxing stance, and you know, of course you can cheat it and just shake
it. I believe that our 21-year-old daughter has the Switch at college. So
I bought little hand, you know, things to keep in your hands to see and, you know, make sure you're holding the punching. But I have been enjoying, I've also been getting more active, trying to get back in shape to try to play out more, and Fist of the North Star Boxing is what's kind of got me back into like in the days of not having a Wii. I don't know, punching apart Mad Max style enemies That sounds
where it's at for me. So that's my endorsements. I know that they're all over the map, but I mean, anybody, if you've listened this far, you understand that that's just,
yeah,
that's me.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Drew, what about you?
Two things, one of them being more of a personal nature. I did check out Spine of Night the other day on Shudder, which has been out for a while, but I just now got around to watching it. But it is kind of a throwback to like heavily rotoscoped early 80s sort of Ralph Bashy, Frank Frazetta influenced fantasy animated fantasy movies. So it is gleefully retro, so like your mileage may vary on that, but I really, really enjoyed it. So you know, I do highly recommend it if you are a fan of stuff like, you know, Fire and Ice or Wizards. You know, like I think that this would be, you know, a movie that you would enjoy. Aside from that, I am looking, it is Ringo Awards nomination time, and it at this point fans can still nominate their favorites, and I am looking for support because I am trying to muster up support not only for me to get nominated as best writer, but also Halloween Man as both best hero and best webcomic. So if you enjoy my comic or just enjoy me on this podcast, please consider going to the Ringo Awards website and just taking a few seconds to fill out the form and you know, nominating me. I would greatly appreciate it.
Fabulous. Thank you. Thank you very much. I will just endorse Julia's endorsements. So I really enjoyed the new Guy Ritchie movie. Ruse de Guerre. So what is it? It's called Orson Fortune Ruse de Guerre, which is a crazy title, but it's very good, and it's got a killer cast of
the character's name is Orson. Sorry, the character's name is Orson, but it's Operation Fortune.
Operation Fortune Ruse de Guerre. Yep. How could I forget that? I'm so sorry. Anyway,
it's a long name.
Jason Statham. It's got Aubrey Plaza, Hugh Grant. It's a really good Guy Ritchie film. Anyway, all right. That brings us to the end. We are rocketing through some standalone, cool vampire movies. Our good friends at the Monster Movie Happy Hour are probably going to be joining us for a vampire movie to be announced very soon, which we're extremely excited about. And then we'll be moving towards our 400th episode. And that's going to be fun. That's going to be just within the next five episodes, which depending on whether we take any weeks off, will be happening in the next like 6 weeks or so. So there we go. Everyone be excellent to one another. Thank you very, very much. Come to the Facebook page and give us your theories on whether these are in fact the same vampire, Corda and Yorga. And we will talk to you all soon. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Night.
Good night.